coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're about to meet the father of AES-67. Well, that's what I call him. It's Kevin Gross with AVA Networks. He's a consultant, but he also served as the coordinator of the committee that invented or came together to make the AES-67 AOIP standard. That's coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, our 484th episode of Kirk Harnack. This Week in Radio Tech, or TWRT. This is the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. How many years have I been saying, I got a light bulb top of the tower. It's just not in here yet because it's all taken apart. I'm still cleaning it. I can't use that excuse any longer. I have got to go finish cleaning and rewiring that thing and actually have it here on the set. Wouldn't that be cool? Instead of you seeing the remnants of some plugs and boxes and stuff back there, could actually see a tower light. It's got to happen. All right, welcome to the this episode. We're not talking entirely about coronavirus, although that is the hot topic of the day. We may do an episode where we're talking about that next week. So we might dedicate a little bit of time to that. But on this episode, we have got a terrific guest that is responsible, at least in part, for an amazing technology that's overtaking, like a virus, the broadcast industry. So we'll get to that in just a minute. I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm in the Telos Alliance studio, well lit up and very colorful here in Nashville, Tennessee, where my office is. And thanks to the Telos Alliance for providing me with some gear here in the studio, and also with providing me with a couple hours off on Thursdays to do the show and bring you some good word on broadcast technology. All right. My co-host is with us. He's at some undisclosed location in New York City where he is that's not the right word. What's the right word? What am I looking for, Chris? You're hiding out in New York City.
Well, I'm not actually hiding out. Yes, New York City has declared a state of emergency within the last, I think, hour or two, according to the news broadcast I've been watching and hearing. So, yes, I'm at my friend's home office. So I'm actually not in an office. I'm in a home, which acts as an office, so I'm okay. I think I qualify for staying off the grid for catching or moving along the virus. This morning on one of the news programs, they had a doctor on who was talking about, well, you could be totally healthy, but you could be a carrier. I'm like, great. Do you really have to do that too? So, I was like, great. Just don't go there. So just common sense, wash the hands, go behind the ears,
Yeah. Well, between last week when we did the show and when we were knowing about coronavirus, and this week, a couple big things have happened. The NAB show for 2020, April 2020, has been postponed, maybe canceled. Yes. They're still figuring out what to do, but at least it's not happening in Las Vegas in the middle of April like it usually does. First one in 32 years that I will not be at because it's not there either. Yeah.
Yep. That's right. And PBS TechCon and I guess the SBE presentations, NS workshops and stuff also have been postponed because they dovetail with the NAB.
Well, now I don't have to finish up the presentation that I was going to do for the IEEE BTS. So my workload has been decreased just a bit, and I don't have to spend 10 days away from the family. The SBE board of directors, instead of having their usual 4-hour board meeting on Sunday morning in Las Vegas, instead of that, we're going to do a 2-hour teleconference where we just talk about no arguing allowed, and we're just going to vote on the important stuff.
Oh, goodness. Oh. All right. Yeah. Who's bringing in the toilet paper? Paper towel.
Yeah, exactly. But it'll be safe. It'll be at our telephones. So seriously, and I was just interviewed today by Frank from Radio World International doing an article on what do broadcasters need to do in their studios to help protect employees from passage of whether it's coronavirus or influenza type A or B or whatever. What should we do to help make our workspaces safer and make ourselves safer in regard to our fellow citizens and loved ones and so forth? And one of the big answers is work from home. Another answer, because technology allows us to do that. We're each in our spaces where we're each of us is probably alone in the space, and so there are things that we can do. And then wiping down, everybody used their own headphones. Everybody used their own mic muff and nitrile gloves, the blue gloves. That might be an interesting idea, just like healthcare workers and food service workers have been using for years. Maybe with all this going around, maybe it's going to put some gloves and dispose of them. Don't use them tomorrow. You know, put them on, do your shift, throw them away, wash your hands before and after and all that. So we're not going to get into all this today, but I just wanted to at least give it a shot. We'll do an update. But the other thing, Chris, and you in the audience, because NAB's been at least postponed, maybe canceled, coming in mid-April, we're going to do a couple of shows. On April 16th, which is before the NAB show was going to start, we're going to do a show titled What You Won't See at NAB. And then the next week, which is going to be because NAB was moved up a day, the next week we're going to do a show called What You Didn't See at NAB. So we're going to have a number of different manufacturers and technology people on to talk about what they would have shown at NAB. So you're going to get a taste of things that are important, at least things that are important to me and Chris and other radio broadcasters. Of course, you know, it won't be everything. Can't do that. But we'll have nine segments of broadcast engineers and manufacturers talking about their technology. So I think that'll be a good way to at least get some important stuff out to everybody. Chris, I'll be looking to you for some ideas on who we need to bring in to have on the shows.
Absolutely. I'll work on that. No problem.
All right. Without further ado, let's bring in our guest. And that is this amazing guy who's got a great vision and ability to coordinate some complicated things and get people with different ideas to come to the same table. And that's my friend, Kevin Gross. Kevin, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Thanks, guys.
Good to see you. So, yeah. Kevin, I was first introduced to you as having something to do with the Audio Engineering Society, AES, and you're the guy who I saw make the announcement about the AES 67 standard. That was back in 2013, in September 2013, so it's almost 7 years old now. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do as a consultant.
Okay, yeah, I am an independent consultant, and I've been a consultant for 10 years. But I've been working in pro audio since like 1987. Started in recording for studios and stuff. The first digital audio workstation I worked on here in Boulder, Colorado, one of the first. And we moved to commercial audio applications. And in the mid 90s, I did CobraNet, which you might have heard of, which was one of the early audio over Ethernet. Commercially successful, at least, audio over Ethernet protocols. And we put that into these commercial applications, things like stadiums and theme parks. The first use of that was the Super Bowl. And the first installation was at the Animal Kingdom theme park, Disney's Animal Kingdom theme park in Florida. So that was the first audio over Ethernet thing that they did, and that was again in the mid 1990s. The AES 67 thing, we started that in 2010. So it's kind of like a second generation after protocols like CobraNet, based on IP, Internet Protocol, which is the standard networking protocol that we use for everything these days. And, started that in 2010. That was one of the early things I did as a consultant to get a whole bunch of, like you said, a whole bunch of, companies and people together to try and standardize how we do audio over networks for professional applications.
I didn't know about your involvement with CobraNet until right now. And I wasn't in on everything behind the scenes at my employer, the Telus Alliance, which came out with Livewire in the early 2000s. But I do remember Steve Church and others at Telus talking about CobraNet and how we wanted to use something that already existed in developing an audio networking platform for radio broadcasters. And CobraNet is something we were very interested in. But it seems that CobraNet was designed for a function that was a little bit different than what we needed in broadcast with regard to routing and maybe living with other IP packets on the same network. And so it seemed like it's there, it's available, but it's not quite what we need as broadcasters. And so that's when we delved into developing what is today LiveWire, and not so different from what is AES-67. Would you say that my recollection would be reasonably accurate there, Kevin?
Yeah. Steve Church and I went over this, and he did look carefully at Cobernet, and at the time that you guys were developing your first LiveWire, which I think was early 2000s, And by that time, it was more clear that IP was going to be the way to go, and what we had done with Cobernet was very specific to Ethernet. So if you want to work on larger networks and be able to scale the technology, you need to run on IP, and that's what the first LiveWire was. But it was otherwise, similar to Cobernet. And then, further on into the late 2000s, more people came up with the realization that IP needed to be the way to go. And we saw a whole bunch of different types of network of companies creating their own IP-based network products. Yours, LiveWire, was the first. And we had Dante, of course. I think those guys were like 2006. There was a whole initiative with AVB. There was a product from QSC called QLAN. Lavo and ALC Networks had Ravana. So all this was coming together, and Wheatstone had Wheatstone IP. And all of this was coming together in the, 2010 or a little bit before then, and none of them talked to each other. And so
that was a problem. Steve Church, the founder of Telos, my employer, was very disappointed about. I know that Telos offered LiveWire, not free, but real close to free, just to separate the script kiddies from people who wanted to do some development. It had the not invented here syndrome, and people wanted to go with something that was an actual agreed upon standard. But you're right. Everybody had these different silos. They would, even though they used similar technologies, they wouldn't directly talk to each other. Ravenna and LiveWire and Wheatnet IP and AVB and Dante. So one thing that I, as an employee of Telos, I know that that concerned us was, maybe people are hesitating in making a purchase or moving into audio over IP because they're not sure which one's going to win out. And so what if they make the wrong decision? And so how about we all come to a table together and we hammer out a standard for something that will all talk to each other? Tell me your thoughts about that idea of people coming together to a table to make something that everybody can do.
Yeah. In order to get people involved in the idea of having a standard, and what AES-67 is an interoperability standard. So its goal is to provide a common mode of operation so that things can talk to each other. It doesn't solve all problems. It solves the problems of being able to get some communication between devices from different manufacturers, but we did not attempt with AES-67 to, replace what other manufacturers were doing. The thing that comes into play here is called a network effect, and this is most easily demonstrated with when you're talking about telephones. So if you have one telephone, obviously that telephone is useless because that's the only one, you can't talk to anybody, right?
And
once you have two telephones, then it becomes useful. And as you continue to add telephones to the telephone network, your phone, you already paid for it, right? And then when there was only two telephones, it may have been useful to call down the road to your neighbor and ask if they have any extra milk. As more and more telephones are added to the network, your telephone has more value to you, even though you've done nothing to that telephone. So that's the network effect or network externalities. And so one company can create an audio network and can create a suite of products that connect to that network. And obviously that technology then has value. But if you can connect networks together, then you automatically, you instantly grow the size of the number of devices that you can connect to and create more value. So by creating this interoperability standard, we created more value for everybody's network if they were willing to implement this interoperability mode.
And we're going to delve a bit more into the history of the working group, the X92 working group. But, you know, what you're saying about interoperability, one thing that every manufacturer of AOIP products, or most of them, offer are boxes that take the network audio back down to what you might call baseband, whether it's analog or AES, or even a GPIO, a contact closure or a collector to ground or an LED input. That's the basic way that we talk to speakers and microphones and headphones and cassette decks, that, you know, things that don't have a network connection. It was always Steve Church's idea that someday everything will have a network connection. So now we do see microphones that have a network connection. We see satellite receivers for NPR or Westwood One networks that have a network connection that speaks an AOIP language. Some of the early ones were Livewire, or an AES-67 connection, or nowadays, or even a Nautel transmitter that, 6-7 years ago offered a live wire input. So that's the, we like to see this kind of interoperability. And that's right. Then that's the network effect. Everything becomes more valuable. Hey, folks, you're listening or watching to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 484. I'm Kirk Harnack. Chris Tobin is along, and Kevin Gross is our guest. He's the founder and president of AVA Networks, and they do consulting, a lot of video consulting. We're going to touch on that in a few minutes. The show is brought to you in part by our friends at Angry Audio. Remember, don't get mad. Get angry with Angry Audio. And they make all kinds of cool stuff that you need. One of them is this new headphone amp, this new design that's nice and curvy down here on the bottom. This is the kind of thing that you screw this to the bottom of your tabletop, right, in your studio. And you plug your headphone in there. It's got both sizes. It's got the quarter inch and the eighth inch. It's really nice and loud here. It'll go up nice and loud. And on the back, well, they look like network connections, but they're not. These are studio hub connections according to the studio hub standards. So they carry left and right analog audio, and they carry power. So if you've got one of those power supplies from Studio Hub, you can power this headphone amp that way. Or if you don't, you get a wall wart for this, 16-volt AC wall wart, and this can be an injector to power the next one in the circuit. So if you've got three or four of these around a table, you just network them together. Network, I say. You plug them together with a Cat5 cable and RJ45 connections, and you've got all your headphone amps. Hey, there's a picture of it right there. This is on the Angry Audio website right here, and you can go there and find out about all the different products that Angry Audio offers. And one thing I want to make sure you ask about, if you buy any of these legacy Studio Hub adapters, these are the ones with the female RJ45, and to whatever kind of connectors you need, this one happens to have female XLRs. If you get this, you're gonna need one of these, right? You're gonna need to carry this over to your AOIP interface device. Well, you can pay money for one of these, just a standard Cat5 cable, or you can get you one for free. With every one of the adapters you order, just ask your dealer for, hey, I want my free 7-foot long Cat5 shielded cable from Studio Hub, and Angry Audio owns the Studio Hub line now. Ask for it for free. You get one with every one that you buy. That'll save you several dollars because these are high quality shielded connectors, good stuff. And the Studio Hub's wiring standard is printed right there on each and every package. Talk to your dealer. Yes, they sell Studio Hub. If they say, well, we don't know if we have Studio Hub. Yes, you have Studio Hub. Get it for me. Don't accept substitutes. Get the original Studio Hub. It's the best. It works at angryaudio.com. Thanks a lot for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk. We're with Chris Tobin here, and we're talking to Kevin Gross about how the AES-67 standard came to be and where it is, and we're going to talk about what's next. So, Chris, you're old enough to remember when there wasn't an AES-67 standard, and you may have heard some rumblings about this working group called X192. Chris, do you have any recollection of that? There was something in the works to tie all these networks together?
Yes, X192, I remember for a while. It was bantered about, people talked about it, and there was a lot of hard work going into that. And It was all about interoperability. And I remember the early days of folks just wrangling, their wrists going, you got to talk to this guy. And the only way you can do it is with this method. And then, well, they don't want to give away the information because it's proprietary. And it's like, at the end of the day, nobody's going to get anything done because no one's going to buy what you want. And then you're stuck. So I'm glad to see things have moved along very well. And AES67 is doing nicely.
So there were some initial agreements. For example, I think one of the first interoperability agreements, at least that I'm aware of in my little world, the Axia and Ravenna came together and said, look, our standards are not very different. I mean, a little difference in the advertising, but the streams are basically identical. Why don't we make an announcement at NAB that we work together because we did the legwork? And so from that point on, every Axia node had a Ravenna mode that you could see Ravenna advertisements and you could play them. And I suppose that you could send a stream that could be picked up by Ravenna. I know a few people did that. It was a beginning of interoperability, but there were other people there. There was certainly Dante, and there was WheatNet IP, and there was QLAN. And so we needed some way to get these talked together. Kevin, would you tell us a story about how the X192 working group came together? Who started this thing? And how did representatives from the different concerns get picked? And how did these meetings go when they first get together? Everybody's got a little different position to come from. How does this actually work?
Yeah. So the AES, the organization where we did the work, was the AES Standards Committee. And that's been around since at least the 80s. I mean, the AES3 or AES-EBU standard was that's AES3. So that's the third standard that they did back in, I think, 1980. And so I've been active. I had been active in that group as an audio dude since the 90s. And so I knew it was a venue that we could use for developing a standard. And like I said, I probably wasn't the only one to make this observation, but we had a whole bunch of IP-based network protocols that were very similar coming out at the same approximate time, and they didn't talk to each other. And so I said, well, go ahead and put in the way you start a project at AES is you write a little, fill out a form, project initiation form. And I did that in October of 2010. And I was an independent consultant at that time. And so running around talking to people about joining this effort, had to staff it up and get people interested in it. And I met Steve Church at an AES convention in, I guess, November of 2010, and went out and visited Telos in Cleveland in December, and he was very excited about the idea. And as an independent consultant, I needed some help to put time into this. And so Steve Church at Telos and Rich Zweibel at QSC were instrumental in getting my paycheck to do this work. The effort started with me doing the background research on what protocols, what standards already existed, what could we use to build an interoperability standard. And that was the first phase of the project.
When I'm curious about the dynamic of when everybody gets around the table, I'm going to guess that, hey, each proponent, somebody from Wheatstone, somebody from Telos, I believe that was my colleague Greg Shea, probably representing Telos, somebody from ALC Networks with Ravenna and so forth, and somebody from Dante. Everybody would prefer, hey, our stuff works. Y'all just do it our way, and let's call it the standard. That might be the easiest thing to do, because nobody's at the time interacted directly with anybody else's. Maybe Livewire and Ravenna had some modal interoperation. Go ahead.
Yeah, the dynamic. So the work with Ravenna and Telos, that came out, that was after we were already in progress and had the basic draft of it. So it was basically a proof of concept demonstration. Can we actually do this, as we were still working on it? So that was very, very useful to be able to show that it could work and that people could cooperate and actually make it work. As far as the dynamic is concerned, these protocols were also similar and based on the same ideas that people there wasn't a thing where we had to do it the Telos way or do it the Wheatstone way, because both of those ways were using some of the IP based protocols that already exist.
Sure.
So a lot of the way that we sidestep the issue of whose technology we should use is we all agreed that we should use existing technology. If somebody's already published a standard that does what we want, and even if, you know, there might be some deficiencies with it or whatever, that is preferred over something that somebody's invented. And even if they're going to give it to us for free, it's still preferred because public standards, there's implementations that already exist. There's a good understanding of how they work, and there isn't the issue of who has ownership of it. And so that was, you know, one of our guiding principles is if there's a solution out there already, then that's what we're going to prefer to use.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. So when the X192 committee was working together, how do they know that they're done or they're ready to present their agreement as a standard proposal? What's the flipping point right there when, okay, let's present this now?
Yeah. So it's very important when you do one of these projects to decide ahead of time, have an agreement ahead of time, what the scope of the project is, what problem do we need to solve? Okay. And then you can write an outline for the standards document with each section heading for each part of the scope. And, you start out with the empty sections and once you've filled them in, then you can say you're done, right? So as we fill them in and as we work on revisions of the document, people have questions and they have concerns. So here might be a better way of doing it. And you've got to handle those in some sort of organized manner. Otherwise, it's chaos. So I had learned from working in the IEEE, which developed the Wi-Fi standards. And in those standards, that's a messy process because all the companies come in with their own agendas, and there's, for Wi-Fi, for instance, there's rooms full of 500 engineers, all with their own, you know, their own company backing and their own agendas. And, so the IEEE had developed some pretty, good measures for dealing with, you know, getting to consensus on it. And all of these standards groups, there is a possibility for having votes, but ideally what you want is you want everybody to agree that, yeah, this is the way we want to do it. It may not be perfect for me, but I can agree to it because other people can agree to it. And we did achieve that with AES-67. We didn't resort to having votes and having some people vote one way and some the other. We all were able to agree that, yes, this is the right way to do it. And, I think that was one of the reasons the standard has been successful.
Interesting. And one of the things I've noticed is that AES-67, well, correct me if I'm wrong here, as you and I talked about this in the pre-show, AES-67 was not necessarily designed to be the standard that a broadcaster implements across his or her facility. It's designed to be a standard for interoperability between perhaps competing systems. So if somebody has an Axia Livewire studio and they happen to need to connect, that maybe they bought some equipment that is somebody else's standard. Maybe it's from Lavo or Wheatnet, and it, so it uses a different standard typically. Each company's got a pretty good ecosystem for their own standard, you know, point and click and bam, things just work easily. But AES 67, nobody's really put that kind of point and click easy work into it. It's simply a standard for, oh, I want to connect my LiveWire stuff over to my Dante stuff. Can that be done? Yes, now it can be done. Is that the right attitude about that? Or should one think about making everything AES 67 at this point?
Well, that is definitely the scope that we declared and stuck to during the development of the standard. You can take it further than that if you want, but no, that's the minimum requirement of the standard, and that's what we have today with audio interoperability.
One thing I hear about is advertising. What is advertising? I know that LiveWire has an advertising protocol. So does Dante, and they're not compatible. What is that, and why is it important, and why is it not included in AES 67?
Yeah, so AES 67 is focused on the transport of audio, and there's more to connecting audio across the network than just the transport. And the transport includes what you would might think of is, which is, you know, we've got audio samples. We've got digital samples of audio. They're coming at you 48,000 times per second. You've got to stick them into packets, IP packets. And, you know, you have to specify where to find each sample in the packet, what sort of header information is on the packet. And so AES67 is... scope is limited to transport. Other things that are included in transport are synchronization, and there's network aspects like quality of service, making sure that the network can get the real-time audio through in time. So there's about five topics associated with transport, and those are included in the AES67 standard. Now, what you're talking about, advertising, or I think in the standard, it's actually called discovery, is getting a list of, you know, what's going on the network. What can you connect to? What can you listen to? How do I initiate a stream that other people could connect to? So this whole matchmaking thing for the network. And, so that's another layer of functionality, and we touch on that a bit in the standard. And then above that even is connection management. And so there are a few options for how you can do audio on the network. Obviously, different sample rates, different bit depths, other parameters that can be adjusted to reduce latency, for instance. So there's some negotiation that may need to be done between a sender and a receiver, and that's connection management. So this bit about discovery, who's on the network, who can I talk to, and then once you've decided who you want to talk to, how do I negotiate a channel that we're both happy with? And so that gets a little bit outside of the transport thing and gets into your control systems for your networks, and it gets complicated. And so most of that stuff was left outside the scope of AES67, because another thing about standards efforts is you'd like to be able to finish them. And if you have too big of a scope, you're trying to get all these people to agree on all these different topics, yeah, you could can't bite off too much at once.
So you're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech. Kevin Gross is with us. I call him the father of AES67. He's probably a little more humble than that, but I think that's the work that he's done, getting all these people together to agree on the standard. And Chris Tobin is with us as well. And Chris, I'm excited to hear about a fun aspect, maybe fun, maybe frustrating, certainly some travels involved, and that is once the standard is set and the manufacturers say, okay, we've added the standard to our gear, then you get together and you have a plug fest. I'm sure there's a German word for Plugfest. Maybe it's Flugfest. But anyway, they have the Plugfest. And the first one, well, the first one I'm aware of here was in Munich in 2014, just a year after the standard was set. They had another one in Washington and another one in London. And Kevin Gross is going to tell us a little bit about a Plugfest and what happens there. And I think that's when manufacturers realize, oh, we didn't do that exactly like they said. Okay, we'll be back. And yeah. Anyway, we'll be back on This Week in Radio Tech. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store and the fabulous Vox Pro. We'll be right back. Hang on.
Yo, what's up? Live from NAB 2018. Hey, it's Caden. You need to check out Wheatstone and Vox Pro 7.1. The upgrades are amazing. If you're a jock, if you're a talent, producer, whatever, morning show, everyone knows Vox Pro. Everyone uses Vox Pro. Everyone loves Vox Pro. But now the features for this year, 2018, on 7.1 are amazing. If you're using version 4, 5, 6, and you go to 7, this is exactly what you're missing right here. The features are a game changer. It's going to cut down your editing time by like 80%, depending on what you use Vox Pro for. And with version 7.1, introducing unlimited Praktik button bars right here, hotkeys right here. I'm going to show you coming out of a song. Bad things. It's a lot of bad things that they wish and wish and wish. So you're coming out of your song? Yeah. Start your next song right here. It's basically an entire production room right on Vox Pro. So it's the Vox Pro we know and love with a ton more features. And now this is the ultimate game changer right here. Effect macros. So instead of hitting your effects button bar and going up here using your mouse for every effect, you do it right here with one click of the mouse, and you're going to cut down your editing time by about 80% without even touching this new sexy black controller. Check it out right here, Wheatstone Vox Pro 7.1 at NAB in Vegas 2018.
Broadcaster General Store is where you can get Vox Pro, so give them a call at BGS. Their phone number, I have it memorized, and you will too. It's 352-622-7700. That's 352-622-7700, or go to bgs.cc. BGS.cc. Five little letters and a period will get your browser to an amazing array of equipment and the friendliest broadcast salespeople on the planet at Broadcasters General Store. And I mean that with all my heart. All right. This Week in Radio Tech, number 484. And our guest is Kevin Gross. And Kevin, I remember our guys at Telos getting ready to go to the Plugfest, and you got the equipment under their arms and their plugs, you know, their Cat 5 cables, and they're going to see what works and what doesn't. And they're going there to show the other manufacturers that we've done it right, by golly, and you better have done it the way we did. And I'm sure that's probably not the way it always works out. So what can you tell us about a Plugfest?
Well, first off, the original name for these events was a plug test. And it wasn't our plug test in Munich that renamed it, but I forget the organization that was doing it, but they scheduled one in Munich in October. And so there's Oktoberfest going on. So they felt festive and decided it was we'll call this one a Plugfest. And we've called ours Plugfest, all of them, no matter where they are, just to try and keep it more fun. And the idea is, it's a collaborative process. We're not competing with each other. It's engineers in a room, and engineers, most of them like to teach other engineers and help others to get the implementation correct. And so the way these things are run is that we would have a set of tables around a central table with network equipment in it, and everybody get a long cable and plug themselves in. And we had a test program, and everyone would run through each of the tests and score themselves. We used Google spreadsheets projected on a screen, so people could, in real time, we'd have a scoreboard of who's finished, who's succeeded, who's failed, and we would the other rule was that with these Plugfests is we provide a report for each of the Plugfests. You can download them from the AES website, but we don't identify which manufacturers are which. So it gives you an overall feeling for how successful AES67 connections are, but it doesn't out, you know, good guys versus bad guys. So we don't get anybody's name smeared by one of these plug fests. And they were very successful. We'd have, you know, the testing, we'd have success rates in the 90s, starting 90% or more, starting, you know, with even the first one. And we've done three of them. And there's been additional plug fests going on. We're going to talk about video. And so the video guys have been doing their own plug fests. And, of course, video includes audio. And so the work continues with these plug tests.
Indeed, we're going to talk about video and what AES67 has to do with the SMPTE 2110-30 standard. But I want to touch on one more thing about the standard itself, the AES67 standard. I noticed that there are either revisions or updates to it. There was the first one was AES67-2013, then a 2015, then a 2018. What kinds of things do you find out that prompt publishing a revision to the standard?
So, I mean, there's a couple things. One, the main thing we find is that some of the wording wasn't clear, and so everyone agrees on what should happen, and we didn't say it quite clearly enough. So it's language is a lot of it. So that would be like 2015 publication. In 2018, we added a big giant table to the standard, which is called a protocol implementation conformance statement. And so there's a checkbox for every standards tell you what to do and in language. And we use words like must or shall or may or should. There's a whole language that goes along with standards, and we can convert that into a table. So when you do a AES67 implementation, obviously you want to test it. You want to test it before you bring it to a plug fest. You can go through this table and check off each of the different requirements, individual requirements of the standard, and make sure that your implementation meets those requirements. And that's the main thing we added in 2018. The standard has not had any fundamental changes since it was published in 2013.
So, Chris Tobin, you're mostly in the radio field, although you do some television as well. I'm mostly in the radio field. And we've heard for several years now about this new suite of standards from the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, SMPTE, and it's the SMPTE 2110-whatever has a whole suite of standards for television over IP and the one that I keep hearing about is SMPTE 2110-30. And this has to do with audio in the realm of television. Chris, have you, and I had always heard that AES67 was basically the audio part of 20, you know, SMPTE 2110-30. Chris, just to set our understanding at where we're at, whether it's right or wrong, was that kind of your understanding as well?
That was my understanding, and I know there's some differences, and people have talked back and forth about why it's a different animal on both sides. But on the TV side of things, still there's a lot of stuff that goes on. It, you know, making interoperability, trying to get everybody on the same page is still a bit of a challenge. But yeah, AES67 and the ST was ST 2010-30. A lot of folks were thinking, oh, it's just a slight variation of the two, but it's the same, or it can be used together. That's what I've heard, and I know there's some changes to that.
So both you and I, Chris, are going to get hopefully the real answer, the authoritative answer yeah. from Kevin Gross, because I think he knows some of these different, or at least you know why there's differences. Just because you're AES67, does that mean that your equipment or your techniques or your protocols meet SMPTE 2110-30? And is that important right now or in a few years or what? So, Kevin, tell us about these two standards and how they relate to each other.
Yeah, so SMPTE was going to look at supporting higher resolutions and more flexibility for production studios. And so they had been using SDI for a while, and that has, if you want higher resolution, you got to up the bit rate on the SDI. So they're looking at a network way of doing things. And so from my perspective, what they did with SMPTE 2110 is they added video to our AES67 standard. And from their perspective, they created a suite of standards for video, and one component of that suite is AES67. So SMPTE 2110-30, the idea that everybody agreed with in the SMPTE standards development was that that should just reference AES67. But as they went through the process of developing the standards and the video side of it, there are some interesting challenges with doing video, uncompressed video over network. A high definition video stream uncompressed is over 3 gigabits per second of data. Compared to for audio, an audio channel is like 1 or 2 megabits per second. So, thousands of times higher bandwidth requirement. And so that's demanding on the network equipment, and it's demanding on the equipment that has to send and receive this stuff. So they put in a couple optimizations in the video stuff and included that in the audio side, the dash 30 side of it too. So SMPTE 2110-30 is a little more restrictive than AES67. And so if you want to connect AES67 device into a SMPTE 2110 network, you need to make sure that your vendor is aware of those slight restrictions and doesn't go outside of them. So all SMPTE devices can talk to AES67 devices. Some AES67 devices might have a wider type of implementation that doesn't fit into the more restricted SMPTE implementation.
So it's possible to use AES67 or configure it in such a way that a SMPTE 2110-30 compliant device may not recognize.
Right, that it won't be able to receive. And there's paper. There's a group called AIMS, Alliance for IP Media and Networking. Is that right? They've published a white paper that calls out those differences. People in the AES67 community are aware of those differences, and so it's converging towards all AES67 devices supporting these 2110 modes. But definitely something to make sure to talk to your vendors about.
We're going to get to the one of the fun parts of our conversation today that has to do with an award coming up. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about something called clock. We know that digital systems have to be clocked because, as a former guest on our show said, that a man with two watches never actually knows what time it is. And it's critical that digital systems all be clocked together so that one's not running away from others, and they'll have to be synchronized. And, all these other disparate systems that we talked about earlier, whether it's Ravenna or Livewire or Wheatnet, they usually implemented their own some kind of clock in one way or another. But AES67 standardizes on a pretty standard kind of network clock. Can you tell me about that? I think it's called PTP.
Yeah, PTP stands for Precision Time Protocol, and it's a IEEE standard, and it's otherwise known as IEEE 1588. And the first version of it was published in 2002, and the latest version of it, the version we're using now, was published in 2008. And like you said, we need everything to be in a studio or a professional environment to be synchronized to each other. We have voice over IP, which uses a lot of the same protocols, but it's missing the synchronization piece. So when you're having a conference call, different people can be hearing different things at the same time at different times, because there's different amounts of synchronization error between different handsets, and that's generally acceptable in telecommunications, but it's not acceptable in broadcast applications. It's not acceptable in commercial applications where we have multiple speakers and we want them time aligned audio between them. So synchronization is a key part. And yeah, that was another one of these common pieces where we said, okay, how we do synchronization? Well, there's an existing standard from the IEEE. A lot of the existing implementations were using it. So it was an obvious choice for what to adopt for AS67. And SMPTE adopted it also. They published a separate synchronization standard called SMPTE 2059. And the idea with that is, television studios would have separate cables, coax cables, for blackburst or tri-level sync. And this 2059 standard allows you to do that synchronization over the network.
Gotcha. And that is kind of an interesting trick, too. I know that our guys, our R&D guys at Telos kind of worked that out. How do you send clock that is really precise over a jittery network? And you know, what statistical analysis do you do to make that happen? And that's, there's a whole story behind that. It's really cool. I think
cool. You can go totally geek out on the clock thing on these things. There are people that get really deep on it.
It turned out that I don't know if that it was luck or just, you know, approaching it the right way, but I know that Livewire clock that was, you know, endemic to and invented with for Livewire's use turns out to be pretty similar to PTP in a lot of ways, such that at least the gear that Telos Axiom makes can use either one now, and they're somewhat interoperable. Now, if you're talking to other AES67 devices, you got to use PTP. So let's talk about this cool thing. From an organization that everybody recognizes, but usually we see, movie stars and TV stars on it. And that's the Emmy Awards. Some people knew that there were technical Emmys awarded. When were you first approached about an Emmy Award for this? Well, tell me what it was for too.
This is an award for, uncompressed audio over IP networks. So basically the thing that AES67 does, and it's been awarded to the companies that participated in the AES67 development because they had developed their own versions of IP networking, professional IP networking, and they contributed to the development of AES67. So it's ALC Networks, which is Lavo and Ravenna, Audinate, doing Dante, the Audio Engineering Society, where we did the AES67 standard work, myself, QSC, which had their QLAN protocol and also supported the AES67 effort, Telos Alliance, and Wheatstone. Mm-hmm. And so this is an award recognizing interoperable, high quality real-time audio on IP networks.
That is so cool. Tell me, the award ceremony for that was going to be at NAB yeah. in Las Vegas in April. That's been postponed or canceled. Not sure yet.
They've said it's going to be in October. Yeah. That award ceremony was going to be in April 19th, and they're planning to have it in October at the NAB in New York.
Ah, good, good. Well, hopefully we'll be past all the, and we'll be past the virus by then, and we'll do that. That's very cool. That is very awesome. Hey, we're talking to Kevin Gross, Kevin with AVA Network. He's put in all this time to coordinate the effort to standardize audio over IP in the form of AES67. Chris Tobin is with us too from New York City, where I'm sure there's audio over IP flying around everywhere. Most radio stations and probably some TV stations are getting that now. And Chris and I both have familiarity with one of our sponsors, and that is this thing right here. This is the Max Connect Wireless data modem or service, I should say. The modem is pretty ordinary. The service is extraordinary. Why? What makes it better? Chris, maybe you can spend a moment and tell us why Max Connect Wireless is the cat's meow, because you've got a friend. You do remote broadcast with this, video broadcasts with this service, even next to a busy, busy stadium when everybody's got their phones open and turned on. Why does this work?
Yes, I have been doing that. And matter of fact, that person right now, I think, is on his way to Florida for an NHL event. So, and he did something today with it. 1 o'clock today, he did a podcast from his car with a battery pack plugged into his Max Connect router and did a video podcast for sports and with it. And it was working very well. The reason it works well is not the router, the hardware, the antenna, the little paddle or anything else. It's actually the account, your account that you have with the carrier. In this case, they have it's AT&T or Verizon, depending on which one you want to go with. And what Josh has done, Josh Bone from Max Connect, is he's negotiated with the carriers a way of prioritizing packets, right? We'll make this real practical for everybody to understand. So you prioritize packets just like QoS on your network in the office, maybe across your corporate WAN. So guess what? You do the same thing on a carrier's LAN or wireless network. So you have an LTE modem, LTE Verizon, LTE AT&T, and guess what? You've got packets that are prioritized. Your particular Max Connect account is at a higher level. And the person sitting at the bar with their AT&T personal consumer phone, all right? I'm putting it in simple terms. So what it means is that the hierarchy of the way things work on a cell site, and there's many very trust me, there's a lot going on the cell sites, and I've been working on this for years. But let's look at a real simple ladder effect. The top of the ladder is public safety, life safety people. And there's a lot of folks in that area, but we'll just say life safety. Then there's the second level, which is business, special business accounts. Guess that's where you are. Then there's the consumer, you and I, like my phone right here, this little guy here. Sadly, this is on the bottom rung compared to my Max Connect.
Most of us are on the bottom rung.
So that's the difference. And what happens is you get to a site, whether it be a stadium, whether it's a sports bar, maybe it's a news conference or a presser. You have the ability to get in on the cell site, get into a point where your static IP – Yeah, it's a static IP, by the way, so you can actually do more with it than just make a connection and do video and audio. So with that, you get the ability to make sure you have a connection. And the nice thing is, and there's many other layers of the onion when it comes to carriers and cell sites. I'm not going to get into it because it gets a little into the weeds. The Max Connect product allows you to get full access, proper access, connections, and you know where you stand. You actually know and when things are going the way they should or not, because you can log into the router. And you can look at your signal. You can look at the parameters and go, oh, look at that. Things are changing. So you can get ahead of the game, something you can't do on the consumer level because it's just basically DHCP, got an IP address, and you're somewhere in the pool, and who knows what happens. And that's the trick. So Max Connect actually offers you a controlled environment that you should have when you're doing your outside broadcasts, and it's one element in the toolbox of things you're doing. And I can say personally I've used it with my friend's sports program, which is doing very well as a result of it, and he's on the road with it. He's a small kit. A little case we put together in his travels in his car. He pulls alongside the road, like today for the NHL announcement at 1 o'clock Eastern, pull alongside the road. He told me he's in North Carolina, popped open the case, turned on the laptop, connected to his vMix system back at his master control at a data center, and he and his two hosts on the sports show get on, and they do a breaking news event for NHL, and he's on a Max Connect sitting in his car in North Carolina. Three people on a video connection, two are in their homes, the other one is in a car. Max Connect allowed him to do that. He could do that with Max Connect. He tried it with his other cellular product he has, and it didn't go as well with the tethering. And he's like, yeah, it didn't work very well. Max Connect came right through. So he's done that several times. Yeah. It's not the first time. This is not the first time he's done it. He's done several times for the last year.
And even if your phone gives you a better speed test number than a Max Connect, that data is not guaranteed. You're in contention with everybody else with Max Connect. Your packets get through it. We have proved that time and time again. Check it out at maxconnectwireless.com, maxconnect.com. It's spelled funny, so you can look in the show notes or you can look at there. Look on the screen right there, maxconnectwireless.com. Thanks a lot to Josh Bone for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, we got it's time for a tip of the week. And I know that Kevin Gross worked on a tip of the week. He's probably got a great one for us. Kevin, again, is the guy who's, the father of AES 67. Kevin? Tell us what your tip might be.
Okay, well, this one came out of our work at the Plugfest, and so we had a number of devices. They're talking to each other, and we wanted to make sure that they're all using the right language. And one way you can do that is to, you know, make sure they can all possible combinations work. But another cross check that we did was that we used a standard shareware product called VLC Media Player, which many of your listeners may be familiar with. And normally you'd use this to playback files, but you can also, it also has a mode where you can stream stuff off the network, both audio and video. And since we've used the standard, it's called RTP real-time protocol, to carry audio, you can set up a VLC media player to listen to AES67 streams. And the latest version 3 of VLC media player has a specific tab for network listening. And it uses the session announcement protocol, which is one of the protocols mentioned in AES67 for this discovery function. And that will give you a list of the different AES transmitters that are on the network, and you click on them and it retrieves the information about how the stream is formatted, you know, 96 kilohertz, 48 kilohertz, 16 bits, and we'll let you listen to AES67 streams because it's all based on open standards from the IETF.
Wow, that is so cool. That's a great tip. And so we'll put that in our show notes. Version 3.x of the VLC media player can listen to AES67 streams. And I wonder if you, now at the company I work for, we're implementing SAP. We already have on some of the products, to be compatible with some of the other big SAP player. Do you know if there's an opportunity if you don't have if you're not doing SAP for the, discovery, can you just type in the multicast address and listen that way?
Yeah, you need to put in a whole bunch of parameters, and the beauty of SAP is you can do a one-click thing. But all of these streams, both for voice over IP and for 2110 and for AES67, we got to specify the parameters for the media. And this is done with a file format called SDP, Session Description Protocol. So SAP, Session Announcement Protocol, is just a carrier for these SDP files. And so if you don't have SAP, some of the AES67 implementation, there's a web page you can open, and you can copy out their SDP file and then paste it into VLC Media Player. So that's another way to create a connection.
That's certainly how we did it at our own little plug fest, if you will, at Yamaha back a couple, 3 years ago in Los Angeles. We got all these different players to talk to each other. And yeah, we had to copy paste the SDP, the session description protocol, from the sending device and paste that into the receiving device. And voila, it typically worked. That is a great tip. Chris Tobin, we're about out of time. What you got for us, if anything?
Real simple. Because given the state of affairs right now in the country, what we're doing, and around the world with the virus running around, consider remote access for your broadcast operations. Think about the ways you can have folks who operate from home and still keep the business going, whether it be television, radio, and look at the simple tools. Simple tools like terminal services in your Windows server if you're a Windows plant, or look for a VPN router that you may have on the shelf. Maybe we could put this to use and do layer two tunneling for your folks from home. The reason I say is this week I've been working on that with a few friends who've been calling me in a panic, trying to do stuff from their home rather than go to the office and travel all over. So real quick, that's it. Just look for remote access capabilities because you're going to probably need it if things get out of hand, or in the case where I'm at right now in New York City, state of emergency has been enacted. So I'm guessing my movement's going to be somewhat limited when it comes to public transportation. I got to check it out and see what the websites say. So, give that some thought. Remote access, even for bad weather. It doesn't have to be a virus running around town. Snowy days and things of that sort. Do it now. Start the planning now. Get going, and you'll be in a good shape.
That's a great topic, remote access. And one thing you don't want to do is do a bunch of port forwarding to VNC running on a bunch of computers inside your place.
That'll open you up to attack.
Use some kind of a service. A lot of people use TeamViewer. That can be okay. It may have a couple
remote
of its own
PC works well. I've used that
remote PC. There's one that I've been using that I really like. It's called dwservice.net. Now, it's a small development team in Italy. I don't know, but it's sure the protocols that you see on the screen look good. And if you read their description, it looks secure. The financial model is donation. I've donated myself. But anyway, it might be an alternative for you. DWService.net. I'm using that for some of my radio stations. Good advice, though. Chris, set up remote access. We got to go. Kevin Gross, I want to thank you so much for taking your time out to be with us. If people want to reach you, can I put your company website on our webpage?
Yeah, you may. It's very, very crusty looking. I'm reachable at kevin.gross@avanetworks.com.
Okay. All righty. I usually link your LinkedIn page when we put your name on there.
That's a good idea.
On the show notes. Good deal. Thank you so much for being with us. Chris Tobin, thank you for being with us too. Stay safe in New York City on your state of emergency.
Absolutely. Well, I ride the subways every day, so I've learned a little protocol of my own, so I know how to move about. No problems.
Carry some rats with you. Keep people away.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll stay here in Nashville with whiskey, guitars, and barbecue. How about that? And maybe that'll keep
nice. I like
that stuff away. That's right. Hey, special thanks to our producer, Suncast. Does a super job. Thank you so much, Suncast. I mean that. We all do. Thank you also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find this and other fine podcasts. They may not all be fine, but they're all pretty close. Check them out at GFQ. What is it? GFQ Network. Yeah, just check that out. All right. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.